Hello and welcome to Useful Idiots. I am Katie Helper.
And I'm Matt Taibbi. How's it going, Katie?
It's going well. You?
Yeah, pretty good. Pretty fair. I would say.
Fair.
I would say better than average.
Wow.
Yeah.
You're back to your healthy self?
I am. I'm no longer feeling unwell, so that's good.
Great.
Yeah,
awesome.
Yeah.
You're looking fair.
I am.
The old sense of the word, not
well,
the tasty sense.
Yeah, no. Yeah. Oh, okay. Well, probably both things, hopefully.
You did lose your tan kind of quickly, though.
Yeah, I did lose my tan kind of quickly. Well, that's what happens when you sit in front of a computer screen.
Right.
50 hours a day when you're not chasing kids around. So,
right.
A lot of stuff to talk about this week. We have a really interesting guest. Not sure how it's going to go. Charles Jaco. We talked about on our Monday morning segment. We reached out to him. Well, somebody reached out to him, essentially because we were so taken by his sense of humor that we thought he would be
a fun guest
and somebody who could talk sort of fourth wall journalism stuff. We're not sure if he's taken the invitation in an insulting or challenging way. We're a little unsure of that. So this could be interesting to see
it's
how.
It's gonna be an adventure.
Yeah, to see how
a
it
roller
goes.
Coaster. Yeah, and he was known for his coverage of the Gulf War.
CNN. And he's had all kinds of crazy adventures. He got beaten, had to be airlifted out of Panama. He met his future wife abroad, which is sort of part of a fictional theme in one of his novels.
Won a Peabody,
really interesting guy and very funny. And so we'll see how that goes. But lots of other stuff to talk about in the news this week. We're not going to get to all of it. There were some developments. Obviously, the show is called Useful Idiots. We've launched in the middle of like the Russiagate furor. So there was, I thought, a kind of a significant development last week with the indictment of one of the Clinton lawyers on a charge of lying to the FBI. And a lot of the sort of mainstream news organizations have essentially said, oh, this is no big deal. But if you read the indictment, it's bad. Like there's lots there to sort of suggest that basically the entire Clinton campaign was kind of complicit in this kind of systematic effort to foist fake stories into the ether. You know, we can talk about that some other time, but it was an interesting development. As we're doing this show, there's a new development. The national political correspondent for Politico, Ben Schreckinger, has a new book out about the Bidens that, among other things, confirms a bunch of the details in the Hunter Biden laptop story, which I think neither of us felt was a terribly huge story at the time. At least we didn't know, right?
Right.
Yeah, but the suppression of it
was the story,
yeah.
and the story.
And they suppressed it on the grounds that it was Russian disinformation and fake, and it turns out to be neither of those things. So that's interesting.
I mean, the story in itself is just about a ne'er-do-well son for whom my heart actually goes out. Although it also, his life, I think, exemplifies the hypocrisy of several politicians, anyone who voted for the crime bill, except for Bernie Sanders, who voted for it after trying to change it, which is very different. So not just except for Bernie Sanders, except any politician who tried to change it.
I'm shocked that you're taking that position.
I know. Yeah. Well, he voted for it because it was the Violence Against Women's Act was in it. But he did try to take the death penalty out. He railed against it. Mm-hmm. You got to give me that. I think I own my pro Bernie bias. I mean, I have no choice. But in this case, that is one of the things that drives me crazy when people equate like creating the crime bill, which Biden did and bragged about. You know, every major and every minor crime bill has the name of the senator from Delaware on it. To someone who voted for it because it had the Violence Against Women's Act in it, an omnibus bill, and he tried to change it.
Yeah, I mean, so my feeling on that is just to quote the immortal NFL football coach Bill Parcells, you are what your record says you are. When you vote for a bill, you got to own voting for a bill. I mean, you know.
But it's still, even if you've tried to change it, don't you think that warrants mention?
Maybe, but, you know. But this is politics, and when you vote for a bill, you gotta own it.
I still think it's part of the record.
Yeah, I mean, for me, that doesn't diminish the Bernie phenomenon terribly at all. Neither that nor his stances on guns, which make sense to me given his constituency. And
thing makes sense to me more. This one doesn't, except for the Violence Against Women's Act, which is, I think, what got him to vote for the bill.
The politicians are also complicated. They have votes that are sometimes not great. Sometimes they're uninformed. You know, sometimes they're done for political reasons that turn out to be bad calculations. I don't know. Yeah, there's enough that I like about Bernie that voting for the crime bill doesn't particularly distress me.
Okay, well, let me just quickly quote Bernie on this. When he was running around trying to get the crime bill changed. "We can either educate or electrocute. We can create meaningful jobs, rebuilding our society, or we can build jails. Mr. Speaker, let us create a society of hope and compassion, not one of hate and vengeance." That was one.
And then he voted for the bill.
"Mr. Speaker, instead of talking about punishment and vengeance, let us have the courage to talk about the real issues. How do we get to the root causes of crime? How do we stop crime, which is in fact a very serious problem in this country?" Yes, he did, largely because it included some provisions that he strongly approved of, like the Violence Against Women Act and a 10-year assault weapons ban. And he backed more funding for police, which the 1994 law included and remains a popular way to fight crime among liberals and conservatives. But he voted against the 1991 crime bill. He voted against banning Pell Grants for college for prisoners. He voted no to amend the 1994 crime bill to ban the federal death penalty. And he voted against the Anti-Terrorism and Effective Death Penalty Act of 1996, which stripped defendants and prisoners of their ability to contest court rulings, even when the rulings may be unconstitutional.
Bernie's not perfect. Can you go there? Can you say that?
Yeah, but I would say like his voting. Yes.
Can you say those words?
Bernie's not perfect.
All right, there we go. Okay. All right. Good.
I just think this case is different from his imperfections. Yes, he voted for it, but he did really run around trying to make it better.
Okay.
So that's the asterisk. I believe that's the political term for it, right? But ran around trying to make it better.
Right. Yes. Okay. Well, let's get into it then. Let's get into the four food groups. Democrats suck. Republicans
as opposed
suck.
To his gun stuff, which he had no. Just to put a bow on it, I understand his gun stuff. I don't like it, but I understand it. And that there was no conflict. Right. There was no wrestling with it. That's all I mean. That there was conflict and wrestling.
Okay. All right.
He didn't try to change the laws that he did for the people of Vermont and their. Whatever. What do they have? Right.
Katie, let me ask you a question. How did you feel when Democrats talked about how anguished they were over their Iraq war votes? They're like, oh, you know, it was a really difficult decision. And
yes, but yes, of course, they're full of it. But what if I had seen that person speak against the vote, it would have made a difference. And I think voting for a war versus against a war, as opposed to an omnibus bill, is a little different.
Okay.
You come on, we can agree on that one too.
I don't know. To me, it seems like the same thing. Like you have objections to it. That the difficult decision is yes or no on the bill. Yeah. And you know, you don't get credit for, it's not horseshoes, you know?
Yeah.
You don't get credit for being close, but that's okay. All right, we can agree to disagree, right? Yeah. Right? This is us being mature. We're growing in our relationship.
We're growing,
That's what's happening.
He was for the first Iraq war. That was a mistake.
Right.
He was for the first Iraq war.
Wow.
Right?
Okay. There we go. I don't know.
See how it just rolled off the tongue?
Yeah. That was good. That was great. Progress.
I'm growing. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. All right. So what do we have for Democrats suck?
Okay. So for Democrats suck, I mean, we have everything. They basically just suck so much. It's not even funny. We got people like Joe Manchin who are terrible. We got Kyrsten Sinema. But as you've pointed out, Matt, on many occasions, they are kind of the effective boogeymen, the bad guys, where we know that people ranging from Chuck Schumer to Joe Biden could, of course, pressure them politically to do the right thing.
Well, their job in the caucus is to be the sticks in the mud who prevent the Democrats from doing all the wonderfulness that they really, really and truly want to do.
Right.
This is their version of wrestling.
Yeah. Are they heels? Is that the right term?
Yes, they're heels. Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, they're heels. Yeah.
Aren't you impressed?
I am very impressed. That was even a wrestling term. We were talking about wrestling.
I know. That's why I brought it up.
Excellent.
Well, so as is often the case, we didn't really hear about this person, the parliamentarian, when the Republicans were in charge, largely because I think they fired their parliamentarian. But the Senate parliamentarian ruled on Sunday that Democrats cannot create a pathway to citizenship for millions of people as part of their $3.5 trillion spending bill. I'm reading a Democracy Now. Democrats were hoping to pass the measure, which could grant citizenship to immigrants with temporary protected status, or TPS, essential workers, farm workers, and those brought to the U.S. as children, by passing the package through reconciliation without Republican support. So we got another example of the parliamentarian making this decision, and Democrats, you know, the party responding to that as if that is significant, or as if that's some kind of insurmountable decision.
Right.
The parliamentarian is kind of serving a similar function to Manchin and Sinema, except no one knows what the hell they are or who the hell they are.
Right. I mean, it's just all very convenient, right?
Yeah, it's all very convenient. And it's all a question of norms. It's this norms. Like, I think, was it Sirota who talked about this with us? How the Democrats are obsessed with norms and process, and the Republicans couldn't care less.
Well, they're obsessed with norms and process when they need to be.
Right.
When they don't need to be, they're completely indifferent to norms and process. But
they hide behind norms and process. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Right. Exactly.
And then on a related note, we have a story about Haitian immigrants. I should say, actually, Haitian asylum seekers. People have probably seen these awful photos and footage of Haitians who have fled Haiti. And they are set up in these kind of makeshift camps underneath a bridge in Del Rio, Texas. Biden, remember, he really ran on being the humane, non-xenophobic guy. And they've already sent back 3 mass deportation flights to Haiti. And they're trying to mass deport 14,000 Haitian asylum seekers. Then you also see these images, these really disturbing images of men on horseback who have whips.
In Del Rio, Texas, photographs and video footage of Border Patrol agents on horseback chasing, grabbing, and whipping Haitian asylum seekers have sparked widespread condemnation. One border agent was heard screaming obscenities at asylum seekers, including children, after they attempted to return to a makeshift camp where thousands have been staying underneath a bridge for days.
Hey, you use your women? This is why your country because you use your women for this.
White House officials said they will investigate the violent attacks. Meanwhile, Homeland Security Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas traveled Monday to the makeshift camp in Del Rio, where he once again warned asylum seekers not to come to the United States.
Only Haitians living in the United States before July 29th are eligible for temporary protected status. If you come to the United States illegally, you will be returned. Your journey will not succeed, and you will be endangering your life and your family's lives.
Driven by hunger, hundreds of Haitian refugees cross back into Mexico and return to the U.S. makeshift camp carrying food. This is a Haitian asylum seeker who says he and his 2 children went without food for 4 days.
People in the United States don't give us anything, just water. Since children only receive water, children are going hungry. We are out in the open. The United States government has no conscience.
Advocates say at least 3 more deportation flights were sent to Haiti yesterday. Several more are expected today and in the coming days as the Biden administration continues its mass expulsion of Haitian asylum seekers, including families and children.
What's interesting about this and disturbing is that Biden is using Title 42 to expel asylum seekers without giving them hearings first. And, you know, today and nothing would fundamentally change, which, of course, is something that Biden said in front of a bunch of donors, not publicly, but it got leaked out. He was telling a bunch of rich people that nothing would fundamentally change under his presidency. Trump invoked Title 42, citing COVID-19, but health experts say it has no medical basis. So he's using something that Trump also invoked. And this is an interesting thing that AJ Plus tweeted out. 440,000 people have been expelled under Trump and 690,000 people under Biden.
Yeah, it's brutal.
Just brutal, awful stuff. And And, you know, I think just remembering like that sometimes it's easy because these people are born in other countries. You think like, why is this our problem? Who cares? But what would you do in the same situation if you could? It's just a human response.
Yeah, no, of course.
Yeah,
of course. I mean, especially,
I mean, I know I'm saying the obvious, but yeah, if you have kids, yeah.
Again, it's just the optics of this. It's just such, it just runs counter to what the Democrats seem to be wanting to present themselves as. I guess they've always done this on immigration. They've just never quite so openly and aggressively, right. It feels like to me.
Their NPR gathered some of the photos. And of course, if we saw any of these while Trump was president, there'd be justifiable outrage. But because Biden's president, we've seen these interesting excuses ranging from people being like, is that really a whip? I think it's more of a rain. And not even kidding. And like, well, someone was like, well, these Border Patrol officers are Republicans and Trump supporters. To Biden is, you know, at least Biden feels bad about this stuff.
Dudes on horseback in cowboy hats with whips. Not a good look for the United States. This whole Biden policy, immigration policy, they've been remarkably consistent about the whole don't come here theme.
Yeah, it's true. To be fair, they were very frank about that. And in fact, we had that amazing Biden image, which we should clip in for later, of him standing in front of what looked like kind of a sun. I mean, it was so weird. It looked like it was part of a brochure or an ad campaign. And it's like, I can't be any clearer, do not come, in Creole. Which is interesting because I don't know who the audience was for that. You remember the Haitian embassy tweeted that out?
I want to see that. That's awesome.
There it is. Okay, so how would you describe it? It says, I can say quite clearly, don't come over. And it's in Creole on the actual image. And then it's translated into English. And it's a U.S. embassy in Haiti's tweet, quoting POTUS. This is back from March 2021. How would you describe, for people just listening, what the image of him looks like?
Well, he's looking forward with sort of a stentorian gaze, steely, mm-hmm. Right?
Steely-eyed, yeah.
Steely-eyed, and then he's backed by a kind of a imperial Japanese sun. I don't know.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
It's kind of that maybe. It's a little creepy. It's got kind of like a 1984 Our Great Leader vibe. I can't say this anymore. I can say quite clearly. He probably can't say quite clearly, right?
Right.
I think we would come out probably a different way.
Here's the thing. Biden is sending these people back, but he's not calling it a shithole country.
He's just sort of implying it.
Well, he's actually probably not implying. I mean, maybe that they're shithole people, but I think if he were going to imply that it's a shithole country, that wouldn't be okay for him to not let them, to tell them clearly, don't come.
I mean, I think the political message here is, we're not letting a whole bunch of people, you know, who are either going to take your job become a problem, you know, come into the country, right? Like that's a dog whistle message of all this. You know, the difference is Trump just comes out and says, I don't want any people from shithole countries in our country.
Right.
I don't feel that one of those is particularly better than the other.
I mean, I was being somewhat, you know, sarcastic, but my point more is that that's not a big enough difference if you're claiming to be an existentially different person to Donald Trump.
Yeah.
That is kind of the perfect metaphor, right? Like Biden has like nice memes versus Trump just calling these places shithole countries.
I don't even know how nice that meme is. It's fuck off.
Don't come, right? When I say nice memes, I mean it's like aesthetically pleasing, which makes it kind of freaky.
Yeah,
it's very weird. It's terrible. It's really terrible. And mostly, I'm saying this to drag Biden. My main point is that this fucking sucks. Democrats are a bunch of hypocrites, and all of their defenders should be ashamed. Because if you actually care about the rights of immigrants, undocumented people, asylum seekers, people fleeing violence and instability, which is what everyone claimed. You can't just cover for that.
Once upon a time, I had a job as a translator for Russian speaking asylum seekers. There's a couple, I think, misconceptions that people have about refugees from other countries, except in very, very rare cases, there's almost always room, you know, the economic capability to absorb these folks. And the reality is, in most cases, maybe not the first generation of immigrants, but very shortly after, these, you know, the people who come to this country seeking asylum end up becoming, you know, our most productive citizens. Sort of vast net increase in things like, you know, gross domestic product and all this other stuff. If that's a kind of thing that you care about, the argument, oh, that they're coming here and they're draining our resources and they're taking my job and all that, you know, it's just not really true. Actually, what's happening in a lot of cases is that we're getting people who are, they tend to be more patriotic than native-born Americans. They're dedicated to becoming citizens of the United States. You know, they're often bringing skills that we don't find, you know, in huge quantities among Americans, right? So native-born Americans, right? So it's frustrating. Like, I'm not sure. The mystery for me is why the Democrats have settled on this policy, because they've moved on some other things.
Yeah.
In the last 10 years or so.
I think because honestly, you know why? Because they're so bad on like trade issues and class issues that for them to explain to people why they don't want, why native born U.S. citizens shouldn't fear immigrants, like they'd have to explain things in a way that they can't explain things, because that would, you know, actually talking about kind of multiracial class organizing is antithetical to them's, right? Like, you have to mobilize against the 1% to do that, really, or you have to, that's the logic that explains it, right? Like when Sanchez is like, you know, but Latino, Black, Native American brothers and sisters, you know, it's not, they're not taking your jobs. And you had Trump being like, yeah, they are taking your jobs. And then you had Sanders.
And they're
saying,
not bringing the best people.
And yeah, blah, yeah, blah. They're bringing rapists. And then you have the Dems. And then Bernie's message was one of, you know, multiracial unity and uniting around class interest. And then you have the Dems who were, if anything, it was like micro targeting around ethnicity and racial background and not around class.
It's strange to me. I can't say that I really understand the calculation, but it's a bad look. And it's strange because the Biden administration following up Trump is like, it's like a political gift from the gods. You know, you get like a free 3 years of press coverage after that, you know, and they've somehow managed to start trending down in terms of, you know, in terms of approval rating and things like that, you know, faster than I would have expected. It just seems like they're just not handling situations that come up very well.
I think you just made me think of something else, though, because we're talking about, you know, Dems and the parliamentarian, and, you know, no one ever asks how we're going to pay for war, except some, like, okay, Rand Paul maybe, but in general, no one asks how we're going to pay for the war. People like to deficit hawk, deficit troll. And so when you're constantly presenting the world as this zero-sum game where we just don't have enough money to do things, that's another reason, right? So that's like, it goes along with that other image that the Dems create, which is as if we don't have the resources to do things and as if we have to make these sacrifices.
Yeah, and that interestingly ties into the next segment of Republicans suck, which is a hugely related phenomenon. Mitch McConnell says the GOP will vote for the U.S. to default on its debt. As the White House stressed the urgency of raising the debt ceiling to avoid a government default, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi and Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer said on Monday that the House would pass legislation to fund the government that includes a debt limit suspension through the end of next year. It was a dare to Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell, who would need to lend 10 Republican votes for to avert the filibuster and clear the Senate. The Kentucky Republican was unfazed. We will not support legislation that raises the debt limit, McConnell said after Pelosi and Schumer's announcement. Democrats do not need our help. Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen told Congress earlier this month that the government's money would likely run out in October because of financial uncertainty caused by the pandemic. Pelosi and Schumer said in a joint statement on Monday that the House would pass legislation before October to fund the government through the end of the year. And then so then it's Republican lawmakers who said they won't get involved with raising the debt limit and want Democrats to go at it alone, citing their, quote, irresponsible spending on a $3.5 trillion social spending bill. Anyway, you get the idea. We've been here before with this story. We've had constant back and forth about this whole issue of raising the debt ceiling and there have been confrontations between Republicans and Democrats about this issue many times in the past. And we did already actually have a downgrade of American debt in 2011. It wasn't directly related to a threat of not raising a debt ceiling, but that was when Standard & Poor's wasn't happy about the way politicians were talking about solving America's fiscal problems. So they downgraded us from AAA to AA+. And that had a huge impact on borrowing costs, or at least a huge theoretical impact anyway. And then a couple of years later, there was another one of these situations where Republicans threatened to not raise the debt ceiling. And there was sort of a stare down between the Obama administration and the Republicans on a deficit issue. And Obama kind of caved in the end. So they've done this before. Just the issue is, this is a situation where just the mere threat of doing this can cost more than the money they're claiming to save, you know, by not passing this. So because you can end up getting downgraded, and a default obviously would just be catastrophic for the United States. It would cost us a fortune to ever borrow money, and we have so much we have to borrow every year. So this is crazy. This is just classic, legitimately like sociopathic Republican politics. This is old school, sort of pre-Trump, insane Republicans. It's not the kind of new out to lunch Looney Tunes. Although I guess the old ones were also out to lunch Looney Tunes.
Right.
But not quite to the degree, right?
The old ones were out to lunch Looney Tunes in a kind of different way.
Even if you wanted to reduce spending, you know, you got to kind of do it in the front end. Like it's a little late to do it once you're at the point where you have to borrow money to pay off the money you've already spent. Like that's not how it works. Like you don't, although I guess you should never compare it to family budgeting, but in this case, it actually does kind of fit.
Right. You know, it's usually used to
Right. In this case, I think, you know, if you want to control your personal spending habits, the way to do that isn't by like not paying your credit card bill.
Although I like that. I kind of like that. It's kind of like putting your head in the sand, but that's not very good fiscal policy.
Yeah. Well, so
because in this case, we don't actually need to pay it. I mean, we need to pay. Well, yeah, we can just keep borrowing.
Right. Especially when you have the ability to unilaterally print money to pay your credit card bill. You should probably just pay your credit card bill, because after that, I guess if you just wanted to make it impossible for your to spend in the future.
Yeah. They are sadists and sociopaths.
Yeah. That's nuts.
That's nuts.
So what do we have for Isn't That Weird?
So for Isn't That Weird, we have a fairly weird story about a TikTok couple that are practice parenting on kind of realistic looking babies, baby dolls. So there's a woman named Jess Ellis. She's a TikTok creator in London. And the good news is that she has a boyfriend who's also into this habit. She spends a lot of money on them, and she puts them in strollers. And reading at the esteemed New York Post, oh baby, Jess Ellis, a TikTok creator in London, UK, found a boyfriend who goes along with her creepy reborn baby doll obsession, worth nearly $3,500. From real life stroller outings to matching father-son outfits, there's nothing she won't do to teach her partner, Avery Rassen, how to be a dad. So let's just watch the videotape, which is really creepy. And she's holding this very realistic doll, baby doll. My boyfriend matching my weird, and then he's also holding a weird doll. Come with me and my reborn baby to meet my partner. No one ever notices that she is a doll, would you? She's pushing a stroller with a very realistic looking baby. He's home, and yes, he supports my hobby. Do you want an actual kid? Someone asks. And she says, yes, absolutely. And you see a little baby.
Do they not know how?
Aren't ready yet. Yeah, we just aren't ready yet. It's very weird. And oh, wow. If you want to go further into the creepy reborn doll thing, here's some more footage of that. So I'd say that's weird, and it's weird on a couple of levels. Here, Wilson, I just put in the chat some more creepy baby dolls we can feast our eyes on, because I guess this is a thing. They're silicone. I don't know if she uses these in particular, But there is a whole thing of reborn babies, and the ones in this particular video are silicone.
Reborn.
I know.
What does that mean exactly? That.
I don't understand. But you're supposed to practice it. You know, it helps you practice having a kid. Why not just use the egg?
It's also, like a whole thing.
It's a whole thing, yeah. It's also used for kids who want siblings, so they get them so that their kids will stop bothering them for siblings.
People spend up to $20,000 for these babies. What they really mean by reborn is remodeled.
Yeah. But they're not made out of babies or anything. Don't worry.
No.
Which is what it kind of sounds like. It sounds like a baby brought back from life or something. This baby won't keep you up at night. Doesn't look very healthy, that baby, though.
That's not an appealing looking baby.
No, that one looks very realistic.
Oh my goodness.
Canadian artist Sarah Gibbs, 49, makes hyper-realistic silicone dolls by hand. There's someone in Iran who does it, too. Lest you think this is just a North American thing. Each newborn retails for about $7,000. That one does look really realistic. But newborns are so ugly.
No, they're not.
It takes artists 6 months to create. They can be ugly. This song is also not fair because it's a creepy song. That's 3 months shorter than the natural way. It's true, 6 months, not 9 months. You'd think it'd be a bigger difference between the development of a baby and the development of a piece of art. I think maybe that artist is lazy. Mm. I bet she could do it in one trimester.
Yeah, yeah.
None of the second trimester stuff.
I think we should crack the whip to get them going on that.
Crack the rain. Yeah.
Right, crack the rain. Yeah, I'm not sure how I'll vote on this, but it might be that I prefer people who are into this to have fake kids to real ones.
Yes, I think it's kind of it's good Darwinian spin.
Right, you know, or are they not, you know, if you pledge to take yourself out of the gene pool by doing this, I think it's fully positive, but...
Right. But we don't know. Well, you know what we need to do is we need to make sure there's some like Fred. We have to make the heart. We gotta somehow get our hands on these dolls and like put in something that'll traumatize them. So like if we make it so like the heart can use, like we make like trap doors in the baby's bodies. So when they're holding the baby, like if they hold it, drop the baby. Well, okay, you don't want to drop a baby anyway. Somehow we have to make it so that...
That's what I was going to say. Like, I'm worried about these people because if they ever have real kids, they may get out of the habit of worrying that, like,
right.
you can't drop this.
Right.
You have to feed it pretty regularly. Right. You can't leave it on a windowsill, like, you know, right. Stuff like that.
You can't use it to open a to keep a window open.
Right. You can't use it to keep a window open.
Or a door. It's a door jam. Can't do that either.
You can't rest your hot coffee on it.
Right.
You know.
That probably doesn't work either. Just for your coffee, it's probably a klutzy thing to do. Your coffee may just spill when you try to put it on a.
That's probably
true. Human shaped anything.
Yeah, you can't play stickball with it. You know.
And that you could do with one of these reborn babies.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Unlike the coffee thing, yeah.
Right. If you're going to spend $20,000 on a baby, on a fake, on a really hyper-realistic baby, but you say you're not ready to have a real child, I'm not really sure what that means.
Well, I think this woman in this particular video, we have to become TikTok stars by the end of this fiscal year.
Don't we have to dance and wear bikinis and shit?
No, look at what they did. They just had realistic dolls. So we have to have a pangolin. Let's have a realistic pangolin that we each take care of.
Okay. You mean like a reborn pangolin?
Yes.
That's a good idea. Could someone make us? Oh, wow. Somebody.
Speaking of which, guess what, guys? Boris, friend of the show, Boris, who designed that amazing logo of us wearing bull. What was it? Moose wig party. He made a... an image of me and Matt on the USS Pengo, which was the armored pangolin that we're going to ride, from which we will be pelting big pharma executives with actual COVID pellets.
I like the saddle there.
Oh my God. Look at what that pangolin is holding is a pouch that says Pod Save America.
Nice.
Does that mean we're going to be throwing the pellets and blaming PodSave?
I don't know, but it's menacing.
It's a great throwback. It has a court jester thing going on, as in we literally are dressed up as court jesters. But I like that the penguin has a little hint of it. If you scroll down, you'll see on his sleeves.
He's got the little, you know, I have a court jester hat.
I don't see where the pellets are going to come out of, though.
Maybe its head?
Could you scroll in on my face, Wilson? It looks like I ran into a wall a little bit, doesn't it? My face is a bit flattened.
Yeah, you're stunned. Mine, I look like one of those reborn babies.
Yeah, you do look like a reborn baby. You actually really do, yeah.
I kind of like that look.
Yeah.
All right, so we have to become reborn pangolin TikTok stars.
Parents, yeah. Because yeah, we're not ready to have our own pangolins yet.
When you began the segment and you talked about how about these TikTok parents, like I didn't even know what that meant. This is a whole world that I'm just not privy to at all.
Yeah, we do. We got to get on TikTok.
All right.
Figure out how. I'm going to tweet out right now, actually. What could Matt and I do to get famous on TikTok?
All right. For Isn't That Terrible? And again, we go to the New York Post.
It's sponsoring the show. We're in partnership with them. Just kind
yeah. of and they're becoming sort of the Fleet Street of the United States. But they've always been that, right? Which I guess is not surprising since they were owned by Rupert Murdoch. So the headline is Man Defecates in Grocery Freezer, Shopper Ends Up With It on Her Hands. So we see the photo of the accused here. Caption is a man allegedly defecated in a grocery store freezer in Oklahoma City. It's a short article, very well written. So let's just roll through it. Police in Oklahoma are searching for the culprit who defecated in a grocery store freezer after a woman made the revolting discovery when she was reaching for a bag of pizza rolls. Nice detail, right?
Pizza rolls.
The male was captured on surveillance cameras defecating inside the freezer at the store in Moore on Sunday night. Shirley Wright Johnson, who was shopping with her two children, told KFOR. KFOR is the same station that produced that story about the people apparently collapsing from ivermectin paste a week ago that ended up getting retweeted by Rachel Maddow. But anyway, told KFOR, she ended up with feces all over her hand after she reached inside the freezer for the bag of frozen food. Quote, I felt something smushy on the bag, so I turned it over and there it was, she said. I was so disgusted, I was almost in tears. Wright Johnson said the bag she reached for had been placed on top of the feces to cover it up. So that tells us something about the culprit, which,
yeah,
you know, he's good thinking. She immediately alerted store employees and then scrubbed her hands clean. Quote, I bleached my hand. I disinfected my hand, she said, adding it did little to deter the smell. All the way home, her children were like, Mom, I can smell it. I can smell it.
Oh, my God.
And I'm like, I smell it too, baby. After reviewing the surveillance videos, police said the man was also allegedly taking photos of women inside the store. That adds a little curveball to the story. The suspect left the store immediately after defecating in the freezer, police said.
You think maybe he's a nice guy who defecates in freezers until you read that he's taking photos of the women. Then you're like, he's kind of creepy.
Yeah, my first thought was that this was just kind of a sad story about someone who's probably homeless and doesn't have a place to defecate. Oof. And so probably not something that you'd want to joke about, but the last part of the story makes me think that this is like maybe some kind of
performance art
or like a sexual fetish, right? Like,
oh yeah,
guy gets off on kind of like staring at women and then has to take a dump to complete you know, the fantasy or something. I don't know. Maybe is that possible
for women squeezing smushy poop?
Is there a paraphilia that falls under that category?
I mean, he looks like he's not that you can tell. And this is probably a problematic thing to say, but you know, he doesn't look homeless.
No, he's got a good haircut.
Cell phone, good haircut.
The other thing that when I read the story, one of the things I thought of was, I'm not going to lie, I can. Anyway, I wonder if they caught this guy. It's tough to know whether this is an act of hostility or whether this is a compulsion, whether it's a jokester.
Yeah, come on the show.
Yeah, explain yourself.
Yeah.
In a non-judgmental environment.
I mean, you will not get less judgmental than Matt Taibbi on this issue.
I'm afraid I've outed myself about something really gross.
This should be Substack only.
Yeah. Okay. Well, that was the four food groups.
Yeah.
Ironically. So, okay. Well, we have a really interesting guest thinking a little bit outside the box. This is somebody we talked about on our Monday morning segment. CNN reporter Charles Jaco. He's got a start in radio in St. Louis in the 70s. Went on to become a novelist. He's a columnist also for the St. Louis American, longtime veteran journalist. Very funny dude, it seems, from his YouTube clips and from his books that we got a chance to read in the last couple of weeks. So, Katie, you're looking forward to talking to Charles?
Yes, Jaco? Definitely. Yeah.
I hope he is too. Like, we don't know.
Yeah, I think he is. We'll see. I feel like we'll be able to find out fairly soon, fairly quickly.
Yeah, this could be a short interview. Like, this is the first time where we're not
really sure. Yeah.
Yeah, where we have there's an element of the unknown going on here.
He also did interview Todd Akin. He's the guy who asked him a question, provoked the response of women can't really get pregnant when there's legitimate rape.
So this should be interesting. Let's talk to Charles Jaco. Hello.
Matt, how are you, sir?
How are you doing, Mr. Jaco?
I am doing exceptionally well, my friend. Thank you very much for having me. Okay, Katie, it's a pleasure to see you. Thanks
you
for all your help and stuff.
Yeah, of course.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, I got mine, too. Yeah. Okay, well, welcome to Useful Idiots, Charles Jaco. We thought we would just sort of start by explaining ourselves, since this invitation must have seemed like it came out of the blue. Katie and I do a segment, a live segment called Monday Morning, where each week
spelled MOURNING.
Right. We review the Sunday morning news shows, kind of go through the highlights of all the things that they say on Meet the Press and that sort of stuff. And during the Afghan withdrawal, we were kind of having a discussion about the sartorial choices of some of the war correspondents. We were talking about, we were sort of noticing that Richard Engel likes to stand with his hands on his hips and, sort of tilt slightly towards the camera. And then, as a result of that, we started going sort of back in time and looking through war correspondents from the past and what their strategies about various things were. And we came across some videos of you and that I'm sure you're aware of, and you were so funny that we thought this would be an excellent person to ask about all sorts of things, from Afghanistan to war reporting in general to fourth wall questions about the media, that sort of thing. And so that's why we're here.
Novel writing.
Yeah, then we read your novel, and that prompted us to, well, one of your novels anyway. So we have lots of serious questions we wanted to ask, but I thought we would start with our original question, which is what's the best strategy for dressing for a war correspondent, and how should they, like, some people go for the full blown lots of equipment strategy, and some people go for the, like, pared down, lightweight desert wear deal. Like, what was your thinking
Matt, did you wear khaki on purpose?
I did.
I don't have any khaki. I'll try to grab some from my dad's room.
First, we were told by the U.S. military before this started that no, loud colors. We don't want you to be visible in case you were on an embed out in the middle of nowhere. So they said, desert colors as close as you can to matching the camo, because we don't want you showing up in, a hot pink sweater or something that will kind of flash like a light. And in terms of the full battle rattle, I think it's just, are you being shot at that particular moment or not? If you are not being shot at, then there's really no need for, the body armor and the helmets and everything, because we had incoming missiles and shrapnel exploding over the camera position or very close to it. Sometimes we would wear the body armor. Sometimes we wouldn't. We always had the gas mask with us because we were told to assume, which turned out to be wrong after the war, but we were told to assume that Saddam had indeed been able to match chemical warheads on his missiles. Now, he obviously had not. But at the time, We were told to assume that, have your gas mask with you at all times. If you think you smell gas, put on the yell gas, 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 so everybody knows. Put on and secure your face piece, and you know, try not to get in the way or get killed while you're doing it. In terms of dress, it was like kind of khaki, roughly military looking stuff. So all right, you know, that's easy. I've got a dull wardrobe anyway. You know, that was the reasoning behind that. I mean, I think in some cases, I don't know if people actually make those conscious choices. I mean, I'm sure they do. When I was, you know, getting dressed, it's like, okay, what's the weather? Because it gets awfully cold very fast in the desert at night. So it's okay, you'll layer stuff on. So I'll put on a, you know, kind of a sweatshirt over the, you know, shirt and that sort of thing, or I won't, depending, is it going to be raining? Is the dew heavy? Is it going to be bloody hot? So mine was generally based on functionality and whatever I had in my closet or in my suitcase. There was no consciousness. I'm sure people who are a good deal more photogenic than I make conscious choices about what it should look like. But for me, it's like, well, this is what we've got with us. So I guess that's the fashion choice.
Right. Yeah. It seems like there are basically two species. There are the people who just do it for functionality, and then there's others who are very conscious of how war correspondent they look on air, basically.
I kind of like these guys who take keffiyehs or scarves or something and tie them kind of raffishly around their neck like they're a World War One aviator. That's right. That's a good look. I should have tried that sometime.
That like kind of Lawrence of Arabia thing. Yeah, I think that that is a good look. On a more serious note, the first Gulf War was. It was really the first truly like 24-hour news story. I mean, obviously they had 24-hour news before that, but it tended to be, you know, the same newscast kind of looped over and over again. This was really the first story that where you got a continually fresh updates of news, and people could expect to see something new every time they turn on the news channel. And you were part of that, you know, that transformation between an era when people watch the news once or twice a day and now, when people are constantly checking the news at every time of the day to see whether something has happened. Do you ever think about that? And do you think that's been a positive or a negative or both for the news business?
It's fascinating. And it's all a function of technology, of course. What can you do and what can you get away with at any given time? And at that point, the technology had been developed where it could be done. And in terms of broadcasting live from Baghdad, which is not where I was. That's where Peter Arnett and Bernie Shaw and John Holloman were. It was because CNN had specifically set up a series of microwave repeaters out in the desert around the city because they figured the first place that would be bombed was the telephone exchange, which is where all the major networks had their feeds coming through. And CNN went around that with just a little foresight. So it's a matter of technology in terms of real world effects. I always thought it was actually a good thing, but we should have put up slides that said, look, you know, this is being brought live. The first draft of history is always wrong. Your first immediate reports from the scene are always wrong. Take this with a grain of salt and we'll try to sort this out. You know, this is why pencils have erasers as the coverage goes on. Don't take any of this as gospel, because in the fog of war and the heat of trying to get this on, we will probably get quite a few things wrong, which I think we did less than we thought we were going to. You know, as time has come along, it's obviously been a force for propaganda, which is something that I find just very, very disheartening, because we thought this was a great leap forward. I'm proud of what we did. And by we, I mean, 90% of the credit of everything that went on to the Gulf War belonged to the men and women whose faces you never saw. These were the techs, the camera people, the gearheads who actually set this stuff up and knew how it worked. Without them, we would have been on telephones. I think that in the fullness of time, it's not turned out to be a good thing, especially as live news, cable news has morphed. One of the things that really annoys me now is that you've got these platforms that can give you 24-hour news, but certainly on the three major channels, CNN, MS, and Fox, it's degenerated into just talking heads rather than using the expertise of the reporters in the field. You know, you've got the ability to bring those signals back live. You have the people in the field. Why you're not using them is beyond me. I'm assuming just because it's cheaper. I don't know. But after a while, you know, right now, for example, I would much rather see a well thought out reporter's package live from the field on the effects of COVID on fill in the blank, the pediatric population, than see a panel of three learned talking heads talking about the same thing. That's what I feel right now is the big downside.
It's interesting, right? I mean, I was wondering, like, at the time, were the CNN producers, were they aware going into the Gulf War that this was going to be like kind of an adventure, like a new adventure for the television news business? Like this idea of constantly creating sort of reported content in a way that hadn't been done before. Did you strategize for that?
No. In Atlanta, I'm sure they did. I mean, their job was to beat the other guys. So by setting up that workaround in Baghdad, they could get a signal out when nobody else could. Mm-hmm. And they had satellite links set up all over the place. In terms of the larger effect, I mean, it was a job. I had covered a lot of conflict in Latin America. So I was called out of the Miami Bureau to do this. And we had no idea. I mean, it was another job. We were still referred to as chicken noodle news by the other network. So
that's right. I forgot about that.
We had no idea. We had no idea. And then after about a week, we started to get faxes of articles that had been done and features that had been done about it. And we went, excuse me, holy shit, what is this? And then after about 2 weeks, I got literally two gigantic boxes of mail.
Wow.
And it was fan mail. And I'm going, what the devil is going on? You know, I know I was personally stunned. I had no clue that everybody was glued to this 24/7. I mean, we were going without sleep for 2-3 days. Generally, the Scud attacks would come at like 2-3 in the morning. So it was deep overnight when we were doing all this foolishness. And then we'd get, you know, jacked up on, Arab espresso and Turkish coffee. And we'd be up for most of the day because in a lot of cases, we also had stories to shoot while daylight was out. But in terms of the larger impact, no, none of we drones out in the field had any idea this was going to happen. And after a couple of weeks, it became very clear what had happened. And we were gobsmacked. Hmm. We were completely stunned. I had no idea that this was going on. And then we got a rotation crew of correspondents and technicians coming in after things had started. And then they filled us in on what was going on back at the States. We went, really? Really? People actually know what CNN is? Really? my word. So, it may have been part of a long-term plan that Ted Turner and Ed Turner and Bob Fernand and the rest of the and Tom Johnson and the rest of the executive suite people had. But for the rest of us, we were clueless as to what was going on until it became apparent that we had had this sort of effect. And our response was always the same. Well, I should have gotten a better haircut and maybe upped my wardrobe a little had I known this.
Right.
But we did not know until after the fact, and we were floored. I mean, we weren't used to being recognized. We certainly weren't used to having articles done about us and having mammoth press coverage. And it almost became like we became the story in terms of how CNN did this. And that was strange and a little uncomfortable. But mostly it was, oh, that's a nice distraction. It's like mail from home. And then you go right back to doing what you were doing previously.
Do you think that that's had a negative effect on news coverage on media, like what you were just discussing about how you'd rather not have to see a panel of three talking heads. You know, you'll always see like Rachel Maddow, Chris Hayes, you know, Joanne Reed, like talking amongst each other. Do you think that the kind of star power of correspondents, journalists, anchors,
or on-air personalities, right?
Yeah, all of those. Yeah, has had a negative effect on reporting?
Well, I maybe it's partially that. I think it's just easier and simpler to get talking heads into a studio. That way the programming will get on the air. I mean, what annoys me is I know CNN and NBC News, with MSNBC and to a lesser extent Fox, have a widespread network of correspondents all over the place. So at any given time, it would seem that you could do reports from people who are actually working these stories rather than have the panels. And again, the only thing I can think of is maybe it's economics and it's cheaper to do. Maybe there's a certain amount of star power in that they want to see the anchors more. I find it an amazing waste of resources. You've got good, smart people covering good, smart stories all over the place. Put them on the air instead, and let's leave the experts, you know, unless you're literally talking about the genetic makeup of the coronavirus and you need somebody with serious expertise, let's keep the rest of these people at bay. But that's exactly the opposite of what's happening right now. So I find it boring. Yeah. I mean, I find it counterproductive. I'd much rather watch the reports of the correspondents from the field.
Yeah, I mean, I do think it's an expense thing, and it seems odd because it wouldn't be much more of an expense to have somebody out in the field who's standing in front of, you know, something that's sort of visually interesting or some kind of developing story, and then talking with an expert in the field or interviewing people in the field. Like, it wouldn't cost that much more.
I wouldn't think it would. So, I mean, there are obviously decisions based on audience metrics here going on that I'm completely unaware of. I just know it's irritating as hell to those of us who did it for so long. And the reporters and the stories were the horses that carried this entire thing across the finish line. That's what drove it. You know, look, I can understand in the age of Trump where everybody was either horrified or cheering and you wanted to have your own partisans on. But after a while, there's just, you know, there's no point on it. It becomes reductive. You keep hearing the same thing over and over again. And there's not much that's fresh or new. For example, you know, I would watch Clarissa Ward's reports on CNN all day, given the work she does, as opposed to watching an anchor and a panel of experts talking about the same things. So, I don't understand it, but that's probably why I'm not doing it anymore.
We've seen this sort of, and I saw this, I was in the former Soviet Union in the 90s, and I watched this process of these big bureaus all sort of started closing down because the companies like CBS, ABC, NBC, they didn't want to pay anymore to keep them open, and they started doing more reports from home, or they would use a stringer, or they would use, you know, AP footage or something like that. Were you part of? Did you see any of that process happening? And what do you think about that development in American news?
I don't think it's a good thing at all. But I mean, for example, even the simplest things. You will have on the evening news shows, which I'm showing my age here. I'm still a devotee of the three evening news shows. You'll have somebody standing on a New York street fronting a story that happened in Idaho or something, just because it's easier and cheaper to smack it together in a studio, take affiliate tape and turn it around that way. You know, I find that absolutely appalling. It's like, why? You have people, you just don't want to spend the money to put them there and deal with the expense of doing uplinks and everything else. I think that's penny wise and pound foolish. And I think that the viewership for a lot of this stuff may have stagnated or started to go down for that very reason. The stuff has become eminently predictable and you know what you're going to get. You know, it's been a real pleasure. You guys are fun, and this has been really, really interesting. I appreciate you letting me blowvate like this.
No, of course. Thanks so much. We'd love to have you on again. And,
yeah, come back on again. We can rate the body language of other anchors. We can.
Oh, okay. Yeah, we could do something like rate the room, except he's trying to look a little studly, but he's got this Dior thing going with the keffiyeh. Now, is he doing it like an ascot, or is he tossing it over his shoulder?
Right. Yeah, exactly. Like it's sort of like a half Arthur Kent kind of a thing going on. Like, yeah, there's just a lot of that. We would love to do that with you. So thanks so much for coming on.
You're very welcome, guys.
All right. Yeah,
thank you so much.
Take care now.
Bye. Bye-bye.
And to hear the rest of the interview, please go to usefulidiots.substack.com. Well, that was great.
It was. That was very cool. Took a little dark at the end. But,
it was funny how he and Hedges were saying, you know, Wilson, you texted that it was so similar to what Hedges said, even though they're fairly different politically.
Well, they're kind of coming at it.
They've been around from
different angles. Like, right. I agree with him about a lot of things, but having done all the campaign reporting and watching this phenomenon, some of it is sort of a diagnostic issue. Like, you know, why are these people pissed off?
Right.
Right. Is it because of this, or is it because of a combination of things? You know, like, you know, he mentioned the union people who are Trumpers. Now, I remember discovering that too at Trump rallies in 2015, 2016, and thinking, well, that's really weird. And then you ask them and they say, well, yeah, no, my family voted Democratic for generations. And then NAFTA came along. And,
right.
And now
family of the Democrats in lots of cases. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And I think they made the wrong choice, right? Because Trump wasn't,
of course,
you know, he wasn't pro-worker in any sense of the word, right? And the idea of repealing NAFTA, like, they never really did that either. But I understand where that impulse comes from, right? Like,
right.
There's just different levels of, like, but, you know, there's also the other species, which he's probably talking about more, which is kind of the, like, well-heeled suburban person,
right,
who runs the local car dealership and watches Fox all day long and has a head full of ideas about stuff that are, like, you know, nuts. You run into those people too. And, you know, it's a mix of things, you know, to me, but I understand where he's coming from. Definitely.
Yeah. And I think that the whole, like, there are people who vote against their own class interests because of racism. That doesn't mean that they can't be, I mean, some people can't be reached, but other people can be. I don't think we should give up. I think that the well-heeled suburbanite is a different beast from the union member.
And I just wrote about this last week, I hope he doesn't read this article, but you know, the
education.
Yeah, the educational divide thing, which is, you know, if you read that book, The Tyranny of Meritocracy, like, it's the, like, predictive pattern in America now, which is the college educated versus non-college educated. So all the places that were, you know, if you live in an upscale white suburb, like, frankly, I do in New Jersey, 15 years ago, this was, you know, probably 55 to 60% Republican. You know, now it's 95% Democrat, right? So like areas like this, educated upscale areas, have completely gone over to the Democratic side, and it's the Republican Party now increasingly is a party of people who don't have college educations. You know, that's where the divide is, right? Like, and that can mean, as you said, that can mean a lot of different things. It could be, they could still be business owners, they could still have high incomes. I think that is a legitimate thing out there. Yeah.
Why we need more, you know, who's
more Jacobs?
No.
Or more Bernies? You know, it's funny because he wrote a column about Claire McCaskill and the white working class, and he made a point that we've actually made on this show frequently, which is that the working class is significantly non-white,
right?
And this whole sort of idea, which is both a political and media created idea of a white working class, and I think it's kind of been used cynically by both parties in different ways. So he brought that up, and then he also talked about how, you know, people, he criticized Claire McCaskill for going after AOC being the new shiny thing. And he talked about how, you know, the kinds of things he was favoring, like free tuition, are things that would actually be popular among working class people. I think that, I mean, I think
of
that's
all colors,
Right. Yeah. Of all colors. I think that's true. Right.
Yeah, of course. Yeah. So
we didn't go there because we were all being pessimistic at the time, but it feels like, you know, somewhere in there, there's some kind of solution.
Yeah.
Like he has a lot of funny lines in there. He talks about the whole business with his observations about Saddam Hussein, about how everybody is like, has the same mustache as Saddam because they're afraid not to have it. And, but he really wants to go into the razor selling business the instant Saddam decides to shave and all that. It's a Woody book, definitely. Yeah, is, so, yeah. Highly recommend it, but
yeah, I haven't read a book like this in a while. I really have to get back to reading books instead of just articles.
Yeah.
Because
we all do.
We all do. We should do a book. Let's do a Substack only book club.
That would be a good idea. Force us to set an example, right?
Yes. So, yeah.
Anyway, that was fun. He was cool.
Was really fun. He was really cool. Yeah.
Anyway, well, thanks for tuning in.
Yes. Thanks for tuning in. You know what to do. You guys know what to do. Subscribe. Do.
Right. Yeah. All that.
UsefulIdiots.substack.com. YouTube.usefulIdiots. YouTube.com/usefulIdiots. Rate and review us. Find us wherever you find your podcast. Make sure you rate and review us. So help us get the word out. Help us beat Pod Save America. You're either with us or you're against us, guys. You're either with us, and if you're not with us, you're with Pod Save.
That's right. That's right. There's no middle ground.
No middle ground.
Stop hedging.
Stop hedging. Oh, speaking of which, you want to see something really cute? It's like a 30-second video.
Sure.
How was your day?
Okay.
Oh, wow.
How was your interview with hedges?
Good. Good, thanks. What'd you say?
Did you hedge your bets?
Ba-dum-bum. Now you know where I get it from, the puns. My dad asking me how our interview with hedges was, and then if I hedge my bets.
Similar injunction to our audience, stop hedging, don't hedge your bets. Great review.
Yes. And isn't Bodhi so cute? And I get on our next show, we'll read the responses that we got about how we could become TikTok stars.
Right. Right. Yeah. I'm really looking forward to that.
Yeah.
Yeah. It should be exciting. Yeah. Okay. We'll see you Monday.
Great. Bye, everyone.
Bye-bye.
Hello. Thank you so much for listening to and watching Useful Idiots. For full episodes and extended interviews, please subscribe at usefulidiots.substack.com. You can subscribe on YouTube at youtube.com/usefulidiots for clips, live streams, and full episodes. Also, subscribe to us wherever you find your podcast. Follow us on Twitter at usefulidiotpod and use the hashtag usefulidiotspod. Join us Mondays at 10 a.m. for the Useful Idiots Monday Morning Show, where we discuss the Sunday morning news shows so you don't have to watch them.
Mike Carruthers shares little pieces of intel and interviews you can use to improve your life on the Something You Should Know podcast.
The next time you're looking for a job and have to write a cover letter, here's some advice from Skip Freeman, author of a book called Headhunter's Hiring Secrets. Add a P.S. to the bottom of that cover letter. That can actually increase the chances of that letter being read by up to 75%. Some people actually glance down and read the P.S. first.
Something You Should Know. Search on YouTube or wherever you listen.